Good evening. Good evening. There is an unpublished short story by W.E.B. Du Bois entitled The Crucifixion of God. One might date the text around the second decade of the 20th century, when Du Bois was publishing such religiously based stories in the pages of the Crisis magazine, to which he served as editor. The story is set in a woods, where a priest is walking in this wooded area, and the priest approaches a Christ figure. This character is both racially and gender ambiguous, with a face that is, I quote, white with pain and dark with passion, scarred with the fury of life, yet luminous, end quote. Christ tells the priest, I am weak, but there is one stronger than I. The priest replies, Him then I seek. Where is he? Christ responds, Her too I seek. Christ then proceeds to lead the priest to a form that, in the words of Du Bois, was a maiden, a black maiden, whose body was like the light of a soft summer midnight, and whose hair was as smoke curling and swaying about her head in a crimson halo. This God for Du Bois was death. And this God had come in order and offered up Christ to die. And it was understood by Du Bois that this God was death, and would offer itself up in the form of a Christ that extends from itself to die. Why? So that there might be life. God then was a black woman who gave her only begotten son. I share this story with you to identify that there is a long tradition, actually dating back to the 19th century, of intellectuals in this country that have sought to disrupt the prevailing racial and gender images of Christ toward portraying another narrative of God. A God who aligns with, identifies as, and reveals God's self in the form of those who are on the underside of a given society. Now, while Warner Salzman's Head of Christ from 1941 has become the dominant representation of Jesus in modern America, with his long flowing sandy brown hair, white skin, and blue eyes, there are intellectuals who imagine this Palestinian Jew from 2,000 years ago differently. Why would they? Well, because this Christ lives on in the hearts and spiritual imaginations of many, just as a particular form of Christ has been used in modernity as the high symbol of subjugation. Well, for those who have sought to disrupt this high symbol of white supremacy and male supremacy, among us, we have tonight our noble lecturer, Janet McKenzie. She is a native New Yorker, born in Brooklyn. She now lives in her words, the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. She studied fashion at the Institute of Technology in New York City. Her artwork has been the recipient of many awards, including the Edward McDowell Traveling Scholarship when she was in school, which sent her to Europe to study for a year. She was one of the youngest recipients of this award at the time. And after returning to New York, she gave her first solo show in the city. And since that time, she has focused her work primarily on representing the lives of women. Her devotion, her commitment, her compassion to such images of women have in many ways, she suggests, to do with the loss of her mother and her grandmother at an early point in her life. But more importantly, she understands that the journey of all women across class, across ethnicities, are woven together. And she grew to believe that her work would serve as a symbolic voice for women who are often denied a voice. Her painting, Jesus of the People, which you see right before me, it was the winner of the National Catholic Reporters Competition for a new image of Jesus at the millennium. It was judged by art historian Sister Wendy Beckett. And her interpretation of Jesus, like all of her artwork, pays homage to two groups that are usually left out of such representations of the divine, save the few exceptions like W.E.B. Du Bois that I read at the outset. Women and African Americans. I shared with the Faith and Life Forum yesterday the primary reason that I invited Janet McKenzie to be our noble speaker on this year. When you walk throughout this campus of Harvard University, the buildings, the artwork, the walls pay homage to the grand tradition and legacy of this Harvard University dating back 376 years. Disproportionately, however, it is a legacy of white males. Harvard has moved beyond that in the past couple of years. Alan Counter and the Great Foundation. They've done incredible work in making sure that women that have contributed so much to this community of Harvard, whether from Radcliffe or from the college or the varying professional schools, are now represented on the walls, as well as people of color, such as David Evans when you walk into Lamont Library. This year, David Evans presided over what was his 44th entering freshman class at the Harvard College. Yet, when I toured the halls of the Memorial Church, one of the things that I noticed most prominently was the absence of any women on our walls. And there's something different, in my opinion, when you walk through a building that is set aside as sacred space. Because the images on the walls take on that level of sacrality, take on that level of the divine. And what does it mean for my children, for your children, for your daughters, for my sons, to see on a daily basis such limited versions of God in humanity? I thought it was important that we brought to this space someone that shows no matter what your color, no matter what your gender, no matter how you even gender identify, that we are all made in the Imago Dei, or the image of God. And for little brown boys, little white boys, for little brown and black girls to be able to look at pictures of representations of the sacred and see themselves. I introduce to you Janet McKenzie.
I am really humbled, happy, inspired to be here with you. I cannot say doing this is easy for me. It's not. I am somewhat of a recluse. I am a studio artist. I live up in the Northeast Kingdom. It's a real place. It's a real name. Howard Frank Mosier gave it that name, and it stuck, and it is like a kingdom. But my life is monastic. I live and breathe creating art, and I go on a journey every day, but it's not outward, it's inward. It's true that my work with women started with the loss of my mother and grandmother when I was 23 years old. This impacted my life in a way that is inexplicable. Just leaving the hotel before, I stopped at the door before I left and said, "Mom, stay with me, because this is really hard." In spite of that, I am humbled to be here, but also empowered. When Reverend Walton invited me, I made sure I said the truth right away. I'm not an academic, I'm not a theologian, and I'm not a very good speaker. And he said, "I know who you are, and you are exactly who I want." So I am grateful to Harvard, to the Memorial Church, but especially to Reverend Walton, because he really knows the importance of bringing this work right now, right here, to this space. I have to thank my friends who have made big efforts to be here. Sue Perry, Roberta Savage have come up from New York, the editor of at Orbis Books, the art director at Orbis Books, and there is a beautiful book here called Holiness in the Feminine Spirit. And we are on an odyssey and a journey together with this book. My name is on the cover. My art fills the pages. But it is a true collaboration in the sense that 27 women joined forces with me to write for this book. And they are pretty amazing. Elizabeth Johnson, Wendy Beckett, Helen Prejean, Diana Hayes, Katie Cannon, Helen Prejean, I said, Ann Patchett, Bishop Catherine Jefferts Schori, and others. I'll read a couple of passages in reference to some of the paintings because they say some things so much better than I could ever. Sometimes it's hard for an artist to put into words what is so much easier to put into paint. I strive to speak from my heart and to reflect that place in me that exists beyond race, beyond gender, to that place of the soul that exists in every one of you. So when you look at my work, you have a conversation with me and with everyone else. I have been told a few pretty terrific things about my work and a whole lot of bad things about my work. One of the best things is that someone told me, when she sees my work, she stands up a little straighter. I can't imagine anything better than that. I want to thank Reverend Julie Slayton for being here. She was at the Faith and Forum yesterday. She helped us find our way into this very intricate maze. We would probably still be outside if she hadn't brought us in. It's great to look out and see loving faces. It's helpful. And I thank my son, who is seemingly always present with me, moving work, believing in me, giving me support, telling me I can do things that sometimes I feel like I can't do. Thank you, Simeon. So, before I came here, I hoped to find a little Episcopal rosary. I forget the exact name because I wanted to reach into my pocket to touch it to give me a little strength so I don't stutter and sputter around up here. Things got so busy I didn't get one. But amazingly, I have a friend on Facebook who is a Boston police officer. And she wrote on Facebook, "I can't believe Jesus of the people is here right now." And if she didn't show up yesterday afternoon, and she left me this, Boston Police Force medallion. So it's right here in my pocket. So if you see me reach for it, I could be having a bad moment. I did lose my mother, as I mentioned, and it put me on the path to painting women. I feel and have felt for years that it is my most honest statement, being a woman, losing women that I love so much, trying to give women, all women, a voice through my art is one of my goals. I hope that women, when they look into my work, see themselves reflected back with dignity, courage, strength. Because in my experience, that's what women are all about. In the mid-90s, I began to incorporate diversity in children. I realized my nephew at the time couldn't see himself in my work. And he was a young man. He is a young man of color. I had such feelings of shame. It's as though a light went off in my head. It's like, what is wrong with you? Where have you been? Well, I realized sometimes in life, you are not ready until you're ready. And I just turned on a dime at that point and began to work with different races, different ages, and children. In 1999, I heard about a competition. A friend sent me a letter saying, "I think you might be interested in this." There was a competition sponsored by the National Catholic Reporter. And what it said was, are you thinking about Jesus as the millennium approaches? If so, how do you envision Jesus in your own mind? Well, that really struck a chord with me. Really? How appropriate, how interesting. So I thought, if I could paint a work of art that was dark, my nephew, who was 15 at that time, might be able to find himself and see himself reflected back positively in that work of art. He, at 15, was having identity issues. He was, my sister adopted him as a white single woman. And I thought, let me do this for him. I knew a young woman who posed for me for several years, African American, and I thought, what better subject for Jesus than Maria? She loves her life, she loves her children, she's joyful, she's passionate, funny, full of life. She'll be the model. That will allow me to bring women into the physicality of Jesus. All my life, I had to take that extra step. Where do I belong? Where do I fit in images of Jesus? Certainly, Warner Solomon's image had pleasant enough. But I guess I got used to stepping aside and accepting the status quo, just like people of color. All right, I can do it. When I did this work of art, this gave me the opportunity to bring us into it. I never thought anybody would know, but the publicity was fierce. When I received the call that Sister Wendy Beckett chose this painting as the winner, from 1,700 entries from around the world, well, I was numb, shocked, and especially shocked when the editor said, would you come to New York tomorrow, put the painting on a plane, and we're going to reveal it on the Today Show. Well, I wasn't going to put Jesus the people on a plane. So put him in my truck. And we drove. But the publicity after the Today Show was so fierce. It was so awful. I can't even begin to tell you the journey that this work of art has been on, and I have been on as a result. I didn't know how to handle media. I was a babe in the woods, putty in anybody's hands. But I learned fast. I did an interview for an hour-long interview with the Associated Press. That was the first interview I'd practically ever done. I had local stuff, but nothing like that. We chatted for an hour. During the course of that conversation, I made a mistake. I used the word agnostic. And he grabbed onto it and called me a devout agnostic. When the publicity came out the next day, I called him back and said, I didn't say it like that. It was taken out of context. I want it removed. The guy I spoke with, he said, did you say it? Yes, but. Click. And it tailed me everywhere. When we were in New York, staying at the Essex House on Central Park South, waiting to be picked up in the limousine. I remember showing Simeon, look at the lights. Look at the lights in here. Because we had a life together of really living below the poverty line as an artist. When I did an interview with the New York Daily News, which I did because my mother loved the Daily News. My father would go to the deli every morning and buy the Daily News and one Kaiser roll for her before he went to work, and she would read it. So I said to this fellow, okay, I'll do the interview. And so we had a nice enough chat, but I said, one caveat, you have to promise me you will not use this phrase that has tagged me everywhere, devout agnostic. He said, I absolutely agree. He did the interview, the paper came out the next day, big, huge interview, full page, headline, agnostic wins. A learning curve. Okay. People called me on the phone. They told me the painting was blasphemous, sweetie. Somehow I acquired this name. Angry people love that word, sweetie. Attitude, you know? Okay, sweetie, read the Bible. I just don't see it that way. The competition asked for my interpretation. Anybody could have submitted. You didn't even have to be an artist. This is my image of Jesus. Fred Phelps contacted me, Senator Patrick Leahy. I'm sure you know him, Westboro Baptist Church. Sent this letter. It is so ugly, I'm not going to read it to you. Pigsty. Horrible, horrible stuff. Bernie Sanders. He made sure everybody who had any prominence in Vermont got it. Then he said he was coming. They were going to come up. Well, where I live is 2,000 feet high. It's a micro-weather environment. It was January when they said they were coming in a bus on this up the so-called Moose Road. Okay. The neighbor was, my elderly neighbor was delighted with the excitement of this. Big time trouble. My mail had been separated for fear of letter bombs. She was going to set her chair out on her porch and have her tea, and she was going to watch this thing happen. People have said to me, were you ever frightened? I said, that's the only time I was frightened, because it was out of my control. If anybody got hurt, it was because of me and this painting. The good old boys up there who never accept anybody, no matter how many years you live there, you're with an accent like mine, you're always a Flatlander. However, some of them did agree with my interpretation, far more than you would ever think, way up there near the Canadian border in a remote, economically depressed town, dying by the minute with no industry or a way to make a living. They stood by me. Some of them said, we don't agree with your interpretation, but we agree with your right to your interpretation. So they talked, all right. They're going to get their guns. They're going to stand in front of the house. They're going to protect me. My neighbor's on the porch. I'm thinking, I'm going to pack my bag, take the painting, go. If I'm not here, why would they come? Well, guess what? We had one of the biggest blizzards we've ever had. They didn't come. Came later, went to Montpelier. The hate mail continued. But more importantly, there were people like the elderly man at the Bon Secours Spiritual Center, man of color, not well. I could tell he was sick. His daughter helped him, former pastor. He waited and waited until this long line of people met me, finally got to me with the help of his daughter, took my hands in his very large hands. He looked me in the eye, and after waiting all that time, all he said was, "Thank you." Humbling to the point of being speechless. What do you say? And well, I thought I was doing myself a favor by organizing myself so well. I want to read you something somebody sent me. This is from Maisie D'Souza. She is from Mumbai, India. She wrote this for Jesus of the People, The Role of Art in Theological Reflection in God's Image, Asian Women Doing Theology. Who is this Jesus? There was something strongly masculine about it, and yet there was a feminine gentleness, compassion, eyes that held a depth of meaning. Looking at me, I had never been able to see these qualities in any other depiction of Jesus. Yes, I had read of Jesus' compassion, but the visual has a totally different effect from the written word. As I was held spellbound in front of the painting, I began to ask myself, was this a man or a woman? He was dark-skinned, bore a high cheekbone structure, and lips. While very typical of an African-American, it could be a Dalit face, a tribal Indian face, the marginalized face in society, particularly women. This was a Jesus for the dark continents, the dark spaces in society, the darkness in our lives. This Jesus was definitely one with the poor, the outcast, the marginalized, and women. And this from a 17-year-old girl at the time, responding to an article in Jet magazine. This is what she wrote me. I recently saw your prized work of Jesus in a magazine, Jet, and I have to say, every time I look at it, I almost cry. I have to admit, I was surprised to see that you were white, but making my Jesus, our Jesus, of color even surprised me more. I hope this picture will let everyone in the world know and finally realize that Jesus was not blonde-haired and blue-eyed, but made in all our images together. God bless and good night. The editor of NCR, his response is this. Much of the church's energy and new vocations have moved from Europe and the United States to the Third World. So perhaps this work of art is a preview of how Christianity will flourish and what kind of divinity it will look up to as the next millennium unfolds. Michael Farrell, former editor of the National Catholic Reporter. And one more. From National Public Radio, Vermont Public Radio. Mackenzie's portrait of Jesus created great controversy since the role for Jesus was an African-American woman. while many people responded to this portrayal of Jesus with gratitude for its inclusiveness, some were angry that this Jesus was not more traditionally white, male, and beatific. Lois Eby, commentary. So how do you move a work of art around? I can't do it myself. I can create the art, but I can't get it into institutions. I can't do it all by myself. It takes visionaries like Reverend Walton, like many people who have stood up and said, let's bring this work here. This is needed. In other ways, people have stood by me as mentors. Michael Farrell, who had a really despicable ending with the National Catholic Reporter after many years. He was miserable. He left the country. As a result, he moved to Ireland. But he never left me. He has stood by me for 13 years. As angry as he was at NCR, he told me he felt responsible for me, that my life was forever changed, and he was responsible for that, and he did not know how I felt about that. He also told me I was the right winner for many reasons. And one of the reasons is, I believe, I've known not to let go of this painting too early. It needs to be seen, it needs to travel, and it has done that for 13 years. I didn't sell it. Whoopi Goldberg called me up, wanted to buy it. We chatted and laughed for half an hour. I tried to get an idea whether she'd be willing to loan it for exhibitions, to museums, to churches, so many people could have access to it. In the long run, no, that's not what she wanted. She wanted to own the painting, which would have been a right as a collector of somebody who acquired it. But I explained, I don't think that's the right answer for this painting. It needs to be seen. So, for the first year, I toured the work with the National Catholic Reporter, Jesus 2000 show, and then for 3 more years, I took it myself in my truck wherever it was invited to go. On 9/11, Jesus of the People was in an exhibit of mine in Santa Fe, New Mexico. When the event happened, the owners of the gallery told me they wanted to close the gallery right then and there, end the show, end of everything. Okay. Then they changed their mind. They said, we want to invite people to the gallery if they want to come and be with Jesus of the People at this time. They ran an ad in the paper. They opened the doors and the people came. And they stood in front of the painting and they cried and they prayed, and the gallery became a chapel. Became a holy place. I believe I'm only the technician for this work. I think this painting is meant to exist right now to contribute to the positive change we need. We need to see one another, no matter what we look like, sound like, what our race is, what our gender is. We need to see the inherent divinity in each one of us. And I believe the painting contributes to that. The most interesting response to the painting has been the universal response from people who have come rushing up to me saying, most of the time really excited, I have to tell you, my father looks just like Jesus of the People. I said, is that right? Really? And I said, yes, yes, yes. Wait a minute, I'll get him. And they go get him. And he's like an 80-year-old Asian man. Or a little girl ran up to me. Oh, my sister looks just like Jesus. People, I'll get her, okay? A little white girl. They're not seeing with their eyes. They're seeing with their heart. It is the transcendence. It is the magic of art. They are responding to that universal soul in each one of us that we know and love in spite of our fear and how badly we treat each other. And I just love that when they do that. Now I know, you know, when someone comes up to me real excited, I say, oh, I can't wait to see who's going to come. And the odyssey continues. 13 years later, I get requests for the work to be in film, textbooks, books. People talk about it. They use it in churches all over the world. There were articles in high-end glossy magazines in Moscow. I mean, they contacted me to apologize to me because following an article on sacred art, which Jesus of the People was prominently part of, was followed by a really bad article on pornography. And so they were afraid I'd be offended. I'm not. The painting is on a path. Painting is going where it needs to go, where it's being called. I am only a guardian at this point. I make the call. And I have a large reproduction in my studio. The painting is a little bit like the Mona Lisa to me, because when I turn around and look at it, it's right in back of me, I get a different message all the time. Sometimes the painting's saying, all right, good girl, you're on the mark. Other times it's saying, cut it out. You're doing okay, move on. You know, I have, even though I painted it, I'm a witness to it myself. I turn to the painting for strength. I turn to all my art for the strength it gives me to stand up a little straighter. I need it. The world wears me down too. Well, I could talk forever on Jesus of the People. And I'm happy after if any of you have any questions to ask me anything. But maybe we'll go on to the next one. This Epiphany. El Papel Picado. I'm really not good at this. Sorry. This painting is a product of a wedding. A wedding that took place in Madrid, New Mexico, up on the Turquoise Trail at 6 p.m. late in the day. If you've ever been there, you know how high it is, how airless, not a cloud in the sky. My cousin, who is more like a sister to me, lost one of her two daughters on Christmas Eve 4 years ago. She was rushing over to their house, my cousin and her husband, with Christmas presents. And she drove off the road, and she was killed. Their other daughter, Michelle, was getting married, had been in the works for 6 months beyond the death of Tanya. They went ahead with the wedding. And And up there in Madrid, waiting for the bride to come out in that stillness, it was airless. There was only one sound, and it was the sound of Mexican papel picado, which are the paper-thin decorations used at Mexican weddings. And Michelle was marrying a young guy of Mexican descent. That was the only decoration at the wedding. These thin, thin, paper-thin papel picado. And as we waited, that's all we could hear. Ever so gentle, just the sound of that tissue paper. And after the wedding, we all were crying, of course, because we knew it was Tanya. Tanya. And she was safe and whispering to us. And we all had gotten the same message. We knew it was her. When I got home, this image began to be born somehow. Nothing planned. Madonna and child. And then the wings. And then they were the papel picado. And they grew. And I recognized them. These are the papel picado from the wedding, but they're black. And their wings. And this is Mary holding Jesus, telling me that Tanya's safe. Tanya's loved and beloved and treasured. And this force is making something wonderful. That's how that painting was born. We go on to the next one. Epiphany. I got a phone call from a woman, Barbara Marion, Harvard, Illinois. She's become a sister. I think of her as a real collaborator. She said to me, if I could paint these paintings, I would do it myself, but I can't. She had always dreamt of seeing herself as a little girl in an image of the Magi story. Where do I fit in, is what she said. That conversation on the phone was fascinating for many reasons. Not only did she reveal what she wanted to see and wanted me to paint, but she talked so fast. She finally told me that she had tried to commission several other artists, and they were so rude to her. And some very well-known names in Christian art told her not to call them again, not to bother them again. They treated her terribly. I was so ashamed of them. I was so ashamed. And on another level, I thought, well, you must be in a different place than I am in the business of art to turn down a commission. It was multifaceted. Barbara and I became friends. When she would call me on the phone and passionately pour out, I feel this way, I feel that way, and she did it, then she stopped. Okay, it's yours. She gave me total freedom. That is the best way art emerges. You set somebody free and you trust them. And epiphany is what emerged. And I guess I can say it's just about the second most requested image. It's been reproduced all over the place. Bishop Catherine Jeffords Shorey sent it out several years ago using one of my greeting cards. It made the conservative side of the Episcopal Church so livid, they created a standing committee against her in Fort Worth. They said this painting was contributing to the divisiveness of the church. You should have seen the online fight because she sent that image out. Yeah. She wrote about it for the book. And it's an honor, you know, that the women of on this journey, so high in their profession, agreed to write for this book. The vision of the editor who said, let's put these women with this art and let's give them total freedom to write whatever they want. And that's how this was born. Here's what she said. Just a little. Epiphany is usually framed as revelation to the nations so that the good news of God in human flesh is available to all the peoples of this earth. Not only the nation in which Jesus was born, the traditional way of understanding the wise ones who come to pay homage to the baby born in Bethlehem is that there must have been three, for three gifts are named, but also that they represented the known regions of the ancient world, Africa, Asia, and Europe. There is all sorts of legendary material about their names and status and life history. And like all good legend, the details vary from source to source. There is yet a deeper invitation in this image, one that builds on the ancient characterization of wisdom as God's co-worker, present from the beginning as God's master crafter. It is an invitation to see women as a trinity, not unlike Rublev's, even with echoes of their staffs of office in the background. The light of a star offers hope in the twilight, perhaps promise of a coming dawn, but certainly assurance of enduring God with us. When I was asked to write for the card, this is what I wrote about it. Wise women throughout time and in every culture know themselves to be seekers and seers of the divine. In this interpretation of the Magi, women around the world find an image of the Epiphany that includes and validates their encounters with the one who saves. Celebrated here in the powerful, protective, and tender manifestation of a mother and her child, embraced and nurtured by a loving community. Here is global inclusiveness and a vision of mutuality and interdependence, the giving and receiving of the three gifts essential to life itself, presence, love, and daily bread. Christ for all people, God's favor extends to all. The Holy Family. This piece was commissioned by Father Stephen Katsouris at Loyola School in New York. Loyola School is attached to St. Ignatius Loyola Church on 83rd and Park Avenue. Very, very well-to-do area. He made it abundantly clear to me that he wanted an inclusive interpretation so that his students would be able to see dark people as divine, unlike what he saw on the street on a daily basis in the sense of white women, white children being pushed around by women of color. He really wanted to challenge that by putting this inclusive interpretation in his church. And this is one of the most beloved of all pieces. Another reason this piece is so important to me is it allowed me to depict Joseph not set apart as he usually is, but part of the family. I hope that this interpretation of Joseph as Jesus' earthly father would allow young men now, contemporary young men, to see their gentle sides and their nurturing tendencies to be validated and honored, so that it's something to be proud of and developed. And because I am the mother of a son who has these qualities, how could I not celebrate him? The keepers of love. I know a woman who was writing a book in Texas, East Texas. She's a friend of mine, China Galland. She told me a horrible story about this cemetery in East Texas, near Marshall, Texas, where the cemetery gates are locked and graves are in there. And those graves contain the bodies of people of color since the days of slavery. This cemetery is named Love Cemetery. These two women are the real keepers of love. Nuthel Sparks Britton, Farside, Doris Vitito. And together with my friend China Gallen, they have fought tirelessly to get this cemetery opened, because it's been an elk shooting range. Now, I'm happy to say it's better, not fixed by a long shot. I said I wanted to contribute some way. How can I contribute? Just through my art. So I flew out to Shreveport in the pouring rain. I rented a car and I had these two women come and pose for me in a motel. I rearranged the whole motel, and I'll tell you, the help was sure suspicious, especially when Mrs. Britton came in her old Chevy, loud. I mean, I was like, oh no, keep a low profile. Came dressed in red from head to toe. Didn't want to take her hat off. God bless her. She's losing her hair. She trusted me. She did. It was like a ceremony, a purging. I can remember when she took that hat off. There she was. I dressed her all in black. And she sat there and said, dead, because I had dressed her in black. I had her hold wisteria, because wisteria is the flower that has overgrown and overrun that cemetery until it's choked the life out of everything else. But they paused for me. Doris Vitito, whose head is gently pointed to Ohio Taylor. That's her great-grandfather. That was the first headstone that was re-erected. He was a slave. Had become a prominent businessman and very successful. That's why he had the best headstone there. Yet that was still down in the dirt. So this painting has been used to contribute to awareness. I think one of the important factors in all of this work is that the work is invitational. It comes from a place of love. I don't have an agenda except to speak from that place. It's my hope that it is contributing to good things, to work beyond fear, to take responsibility. Woman offered number 5. One of 6 paintings in a series begun with a nude version of this 6 feet tall. She was standing. And I couldn't get that painting shown anywhere. Nobody would show it. I had a board of trustees come. I was already with the work and the show. They came to approve it. They were all women. They turned their back on the work. Finally, I said, "Don't you see that painting?" And it opened a floodgate. They said, "We can't show that. We can't show it. It's too dangerous. It'll create such a bad response." "All right, I understand." So I painted another one. This time I draped her. And she did get shown. And then four more were born. And then this one. I'll tell you very briefly a beautiful thing that happened when I was at the Karen Dillette Center in St. Paul. And that there's a place in St. Paul where called Sophia's Place. It's a safe house for women. And they had a group of women from Africa there. They were all trafficked women. And they came over. The painting was there. They never made eye contact with me. I was engaging. I tried to talk to them. Nope. They moved like a school of fish. They just stayed all together and moved around the room looking at all the work as one amorphous body. And they're like, their little feet, they were all moving like this all together. They wanted to stick together. They got to that painting, and that's where they stayed. And then they began to talk to me. That painting opened them up. That was their life. That's what they know. They said, "This painting has to be seen in Africa. Your work needs to go to Africa. We know this." Diana Hayes wrote about this painting. This is what she said. "From time immemorial, women of all races and ethnicities, of all classes, have been nailed to the cross of Jesus Christ. Willingly, even eagerly, some have climbed up and hung, believing that in doing so, their sacrifice of love, their martyrdom, will protect them, their families, and especially their children. Others, unwilling and unasked, have been forced onto their crosses by those they love and by the societies in which they live, again for their own protection and the good of society. In reality, they are crucified solely because they are women, and that, the world teaches, is the role of women, to sacrifice themselves, their hopes, dreams, and aspirations for everyone. Come down from that cross. If Jesus were to return today, would these not be some of the first words he would say in our world? Come down, stop sacrificing yourself for the alleged sins and those of others. It is no sin to be a woman. It is a grace given by God." Go on. "Madonna and Child, Boundless Love" was acquired by the Archdiocese of Chicago. And there it hangs. Thanks to my friend, Sister Anita Baird, who also wrote for the book. It was one of my first, and I love this painting a lot because it's one of my first paintings of Mary and Jesus. Sometimes people say to me, "Why do you paint that Mary who's dark with that white Jesus?" That's her biological child. I always try to work with real mothers and real children because that love, that connection is what you feel. It's what comes through. It's the love that's in that painting between the two of them. That is the subject of that painting. It is the love between that mother and that child. This is my last piece. Because I want you to know my friend, Sally Goodrich. Don and Sally Goodrich lived in Bennington, Vermont, and their son, Peter Goodrich, was killed on 9/11 in the second plane to hit the trade centers. And I met them as a result of this. They were trying to rebuild their life. A friend said, "You should meet Janet. She has some very healing work." And I met them. Later on, they went on to acquire this painting. Sally told me one time that their marriage, their life together, could have fallen apart, just imploded, with the suffering that they felt. They didn't do that. They took the money, some of it that they got from the Victims Fund, and set up the Peter Goodrich Foundation. They took the money and they went to the Logar province in Afghanistan and they built a school for girls. They were one of the first to do that. Sally died 2 years ago from cancer, and she asked that some of her ashes go back to Afghanistan. So with some help, wasn't easy, her husband Don took them back to Afghanistan, and some were buried with Pete in an orchard that she loved. She told me how much it meant to her to get one bone back from Pete. One leg bone. That's all they got. And they buried him. She was joyful at that. Just joyful. So these, I want you to hear her words. Homage to 9/11. Sarah Goodrich. That was her real name. We all called her Sally. On September 11th, we were an intact family, a family that thought it reveled in chaos. By the middle of that day, we understood viscerally what chaos really is. It leaves a mother incapable of knowing how she will reconstruct a family without its cherished oldest son. It hands a parent silence in place of a voice that telephoned home often. It left us in shock, but not in privacy. Peter's death on board the second plane to hit the World Trade Center marked the opening of a chasm. We could not revisit the past without pain. We could not tolerate the present, and we could not conceive of a future. Peter's death completely and irrevocably altered every aspect of our lives. So complete was the transformation, we could not recognize who we had become. And a very beautiful part of all this, which ties into the title of this talk, which is Longing and Hope, is the very end of this book, which Sally wrote. It is a quote, and how beautiful and how relevant, not only to here now in Boston, after what's happened, 9/11, but for the future, on so many levels. She wrote this, "I see in the flowers held by the women as a message of hope. The kind of hope that Václav Havel, the former president of the Czech Republic, described in Disturbing the Peace." And this is what he said. "The kind of love, the kind of hope I often think about, I understand above all as a state of mind, not a state of the world. Either we have hope within us or we don't. It is a dimension of the soul and not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. It is an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world that is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. It is this hope, above all, which gives strength to live and continually try new things. So that's it. That's my talk. Thanks.
Listen, we are so we so appreciate Janet McKenzie's love offering onto us on tonight. Listen, one of the things that we like to do here at the Memorial Church is create opportunities for fellowship. And rather than having a traditional Q&A moment, as we do at some lectures, we wanted to have a more intimate environment. And so we've actually opening up the memorial room to you. We're going to begin a wine and cheese reception over there now, where you're free to come over, have a conversation. We actually also have some copies of Janet McKenzie's book that she was reading from that are full of many of her portraits that you can purchase, and she would love to sign for you. But also just so that you can get to come over, ask questions, and that we can even debrief with one another about this wonderful gift of love that we received on tonight. The pictures will stay up in here. We invite you to come and look at them. We just ask that you would please not touch any of the paintings. That's all that we would ask. Please do not touch any of the paintings, but please feel free to come forward, take pictures, take photographs, but definitely come join us now. Come join Janet McKenzie in the memorial room. We look forward to seeing you there.